In Michigan, a new berry is showing up on grocery store shelves. It's called a Saskatoon. It's common in Canada, but was almost unheard of in the U.S. until a few years ago. Now a group of rookie farmers in Michigan is building a new industry with hopes that the berry will take off in the States. Peter Payette of Interlochen Public Radio reports.
Steve Ducheney's been looking forward to this day for 6 years. Today, he's delivering a few cases of dark purple Saskatoons to a grocery store in northern Michigan.
You know, you guys just call me, you know, when you're getting low or whatever, just give me a call and we'll make it happen.
Saskatoons look a lot like a blueberry, both the plant and the fruit, even though the shrub is more closely related to an apple tree. Some people describe them as having a nutty flavor, like an almond. But Ducheney has trouble describing the taste.
Every time I eat them, I get a different flavor. The other day, I had somebody tell me they taste like peach, and that was the first time I heard that one.
There are about 20 Saskatoon growers in northern Michigan, and most had never farmed before. One is a retired auto worker. Another was a school superintendent. Steve Ducheney is actually a cabinet maker who planted Saskatoons after the economy here crashed in 2008.
I thought, boy, I need to do something else to make some more money, and we have 3 acres of property out there, and I get tired of mowing the grass. The grass doesn't make me any money, so I thought I need to plant something in the yard that's going to help boost our income.
Ducheney will be busy this month harvesting berries. In addition to deliveries, he opens his small farm to people who want to pick Saskatoons themselves. Rich Fozzie's wife sent him over for berries for a pie. He thinks Saskatoons taste like a cross between blueberries and cherries.
They're real sweet. That's why I kind of threw cherry in there, because it's not exactly like a blueberry.
Fozzie has seen a wild variety of this plant before, what is sometimes called a Juneberry in Michigan. But he says those berries weren't like these.
These are bigger, have fewer seeds than the wild ones.
It was Canadian farmers who first began cultivating wild Saskatoons more than 30 years ago. And it was in Canada where Steve Fouch first encountered the plant about a decade ago. Fouch is a retired Michigan State University extension agent, and he started promoting Saskatoons in northern Michigan because the plant is cold hardy and the soil here is just right. This part of Michigan mainly grows cherries, and Fouch says people were skeptical.
People sort of sit back and say, this is such a great thing. Why wasn't this here 100 years ago? You know, I tell people the same thing. The first cherry tree was planted, you know, in the late 1800s, okay, in the area on Autonome Mission Peninsula. And people probably laughed when they started talking about, well, maybe this would be a good commercial fruit.
Now the Saskatoon industry has grown to the point that a few farmers, like Steve Ducheney, can supply grocery stores. He'll even deliver fruit into suburban Detroit, about 4 hours south. Ducheney's also been working in the kitchen, developing products with Saskatoons.
Like the jams and the jellies and the pie fillings. I just did a Saskatoon bourbon barbecue sauce the other day, and it is really good.
In fact, things are looking so good that Steve Ducheney is considering getting out of the furniture-making business. He says the day can't come soon enough when he puts down his woodworking tools and picks up his apron and garden shears full time. For NPR News, I'm Peter Payette in Interlochen, Michigan.
Stress. It's a normal part of life, but how we deal with it can make a big difference to our overall health. In our poll with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Harvard School of Public Health, lots of people told us that when they are stressed, they try to eat healthfully. Try, but stress tends to tug people in the other direction. As part of our series Stressed Out, NPR's Allison Aubrey reports on the role our diets play in either making stress worse or helping us keep it under control.
At a time when many families lead super busy, overscheduled lives, it's not a surprise that lots of us go, go, go until we just can't.
I can recall absolutely an instance.
Melanie Dawson is a mom who lives in St. Louis Park, Minnesota.
I've had a lot of experience with those stressful days.
Most recently, it was all the end of school year events with concerts, trips, ceremonies. The busyness, the pace of life reached a crescendo.
Trying to fit everything in, trying to make sure everybody is happy.
The juggling act of kids, careers, activities can just wear us down.
And I notice that when I'm really stressed and overwhelmed, I crave something that's just really sweet and complete sugar.
Lots of us have been there. About a third of the people in our poll told us that their diets change during times of stress. They tend to eat more. And sugars, as well as refined carbohydrates that our bodies turn into sugar quickly, such as crackers, chips, white bread, white pasta, are the things we reach for. Melanie's recent stress craving led her to a favorite childhood candy, Smarties.
you know, in the moment, it sure tasted good going down. And then the sugar crash comes and I feel terrible.
Her mood takes a turn for the worse. Melanie says she's gotten much better at fending off these sugar urges. She's pretty health conscious and says she knows better. But for many people, it's a trap they're not even aware of. Here's physician David Ludwig of Boston Children's Hospital.
There can be a bit of a vicious cycle. When we feel stressed, we seek foods that are going to comfort us immediately. But oftentimes, those foods are the very ones that lead to surges and crashes and hormones and blood sugar that increase our susceptibility to new stresses.
Ludwig says, of course it's true that we can't control lots of the events and circumstances that lead to stress in our lives.
But our body chemistry can very much affect how that stress gets to us.
Now, for those of you who can't imagine how a simple breakfast choice, say a white bagel or even a package of instant oatmeal, could amp up your stress response, well, consider a study that Ludwig and his colleagues published several years back. They gave a group of teenage boys different types of breakfast meals. One included protein-rich eggs, and another included high-fiber steel-cut oats, which provide for a slow release of energy. Now, a third meal was a bowl of instant oatmeal, which is digested much more rapidly.
After the highly refined instant oatmeal, blood sugar surged, but then crashed a few hours later. And when that happened, the hormone adrenaline, or epinephrine, surged to very high levels.
So the teenagers produced high levels of a stress hormone in response to eating the highly refined carbs. Now, the boys in the study were overweight, and Ludwig says just as there are differences among people in susceptibility to diseases, there are differences in response to foods, too. Not all of us are as sensitive or would have the same response, but he says what's become clear is that what we eat can influence much more than our waistlines.
There have been studies for decades showing how different foods can affect our risk for cardiovascular disease and diabetes. But why should it be so surprising that the nature of the foods we eat could also affect our emotional and mental well-being?
So if eating lots of sugar and refined carbs can exacerbate our responses to stress, are there other types of foods that might make us more resilient? Researcher Joe Hibblin of the National Institutes of Health studies this question.
I think there's a very strong connection between what you eat and your mood.
I've met up with Hibblin at a local grocery store where he leads me directly to the fish counter.
I see a big variety of fish. I see salmon and halibut. It's beautiful and fresh, and I'm getting hungry looking at it.
All of these fish, he explains, are chock full of omega-3 fatty acids. Now, a lot of people know of the omega-3 connection to heart health, but Hibblin has spent 20 years investigating links with emotional health.
One of the most basic ways omega-3s help to regulate mood is quieting down your response to inflammation.
He says when you get walloped by something, whether it's a virus or an emotional stressor, you want to bounce back as quickly as possible.
You can either be good at weathering a lot of stresses, or you can be brittle. And omega-3 fatty acids make your stress system more flexible.
Both by helping cells in the brain communicate better, and he believes by protecting neurons against the damage that can be done by high levels of stress hormones over a long period of time. And this, he believes, leads to more emotional resiliency.
When you do look at people who eat more fish, they have less depression. They have less aggression.
Now, not all studies have shown this convincingly, but Hibblin points to a growing body of evidence. For instance, a study of school children in England linking omega-3s to improved behaviors, more pro-social behaviors, and to several clinical trials that have found omega-3s may help control depressive symptoms and promote feelings of well-being.
When I started eating fish more myself, when I really started eating it regularly, it was an aha moment.
He says he started to notice that he was more inclined to stay on an even keel and less likely to buckle to stress.
That's Allison Aubrey. And Allison, you're here with us in the studio to talk more about this connection between food and mood. I was listening to that researcher talk about the salmon and the halibut. And, I was thinking these are expensive items.
One reason
people don't eat more fish is the cost. So what about alternatives?
Well, the most affordable options that come to mind would be canned tuna and sardines. These are a fraction of the cost of fresh fish, but still good sources of omega-3s. And there are also plant-based sources of omega-3s, such as flaxseed and chia seeds. One of the easiest ways to get flaxseed into your diet would be to buy a bag of milled or ground flaxseed at the store, sprinkle it on yogurt, put it in your cereal. And similarly with chia, there are lots of chia seed powders, so you can add them to shakes and smoothies. So those are some good options.
Of course, talking food, it's breakfast time.
That's right.
You have brought in a meal yourself. This meal includes eggs. Tell us what you've got.
Yeah. So, we've talked about omega-3s, but there are a host of other foods and nutrients that are thought to play some role in helping to regulate our moods. So what I have here in front of me is a plate of scrambled eggs that I made at home before coming in. It's got greens. And what I'm doing now is I'm sprinkling some pumpkin seeds on top here. A professor at Columbia University, a psychiatrist, Drew Ramsey, turned me on to this combination. He calls it his stress busting breakfast.
Okay, tell us a little more specifically, what is there on the plate that might be helpful?
So the eggs are a good source of protein, which, as we've just heard, can be satiating and tend to stave off hunger longer than if we were to just eat, say a bagel. And eggs, along with other protein-rich foods, such as beans, meat, and some grains, provide many of the essential amino acids that our brains and bodies need to function well. Buried under my eggs here are these greens. I've got Swiss chard, I think Drew prefers kale. And these are just chock full of lots of vitamins and nutrients. So everything from vitamin A to vitamin K to potassium. So incredibly nutrient dense, and that supports good brain function. So I think the bottom line here is that, no food that you're going to eat is going to take away your stress. But if you eat meals like this that are nutrient dense, have good amounts of protein and healthy fats, this can affect how the stress gets to us.
Allison, your eggs are getting cold. Thank you for joining us. NPR's Allison Aubrey covers food and health.
And you're right, these eggs are getting cold.
It's not easy for scientists to figure out what people ate in millennia past, especially when it comes to fruits and vegetables. But archaeologists studying a prehistoric site in Sudan used an ingenious technique. NPR's Ray Ellen Bichelle tells us about it.
Karen Hardy is an archaeologist at the Autonomous University of Barcelona. She started to think about dental plaque.
When you eat, you get this kind of film of dental plaque over your teeth, and if you don't clean it off, it mixes up with bits of food, and it gets stuck in this area below the gum, and it can calcify within about 2 weeks. And once it's calcified, it's very hard.
So hard that it can last thousands of years. Hardy and her colleagues were studying skeletons from a burial site called Al-Kadai in central Sudan. It was used between around 2,000 and 9,000 years ago, since before farming. Prehistoric folk were not known for their flossing habits, and because of that, dental plaque scraped from their molars turned out to be archaeological gold.
We get all sorts of different things.
Sand, dirt, evidence of carbon from breathing smoke from a fire.
Starch granules from carbohydrates.
Pollen.
Plant fibers. Microfossils.
And to their surprise, they found evidence that people were eating a plant called purple nutsedge, or Cyperus rotundus. It looks like grass with a network of roots like little potatoes. Ted Webster is a weed scientist with the USDA. He wrote his PhD on nutsedges, and he ate one, raw.
Not very tasty. It tastes a lot like dirt.
But for a hunter-gatherer, it was great. A starchy pack of energy that grew everywhere. And it contains lysine, an amino acid we need to survive. Even when they became farmers, people in the area were still eating it, 7,000 years later. But at some point, it lost its charm. By the 1970s, botanists branded purple nutsedge as the world's worst weed.
They listed it as being a problem in 92 countries and 52 different crops.
But a weed is just a plant growing in the wrong place at the wrong time. Hardy says it wasn't just the prehistoric Sudanese who valued it. Ancient Egyptians used it to make perfume. It was a staple for some aboriginal populations. And it may even have prevented tooth decay. In one group of skeletons, Hardy's group found fewer cavities than they expected for the time period. Turns out, nutsedge produces antibacterial chemicals.
That's why this study was very exciting, because we identified a plant that has been forgotten about that has all these wonderful qualities.
Hardy's team published their work on the healthy prehistoric snacks in the journal PLOS ONE. Rael and Bichelle, NPR News.
Craft brewers like to experiment with different ingredients, using fruits, spices, even oysters, to make specialty beers. Now a brewery in Maine is trying seaweed. The state is home to an emerging seaweed aquaculture industry. One craft beer maker there is partnering with seaweed farmers. Maine Public Radio's Jay Field reports on Seabelt Scotch Ale, brewed with sugar kelp.
Sarah Redmond is an activist for seaweed. She spends her days teaching people how to farm it just offshore.
We know that if we can figure out how to farm it on sea farms, then we'll be able to provide more of a sustainable source of seaweeds for exciting new products.
This summer, Redmond has been contributing a bit of her expertise to one of those new products.
What we've done so far is that we've mashed in the beer, meaning that we've steeped the grains for about an hour.
It's a Wednesday afternoon, a little after 4, and owner David Carlson and his crew are getting ready to add a special ingredient to a new beer boiling away in one of the tanks at the Marshall Wharf Brewing Company on Maine's mid-coast. Marshall Wharf has a reputation for making some unconventional beers. A stout with locally sourced oysters, for example, and a wheat-infused Kolsch with jalapeno and habanero peppers. A few years ago, Carlson got inspired by a beer from Scotland called Kelpie, made with seaweed.
If there's seaweed in Maine, that's a good product. Why not try putting it in the beer?
Carlson digs into a plastic bag and pulls out handfuls of dried sugar kelp. He gives some to Sarah Redmond, and the two climb up to a small platform at the top of the tank.
All this has to go in, so there's nothing pretty about it. Just grab and toss.
The brittle strips of seaweed disappear into the steam. In all, 6 pounds of dried kelp, the equivalent of 60 pounds of wet seaweed, go into this 200-gallon batch of Scotch ale called Seabelt. Now, at this point, if you haven't thought this already, you may be saying to yourself, seaweed and beer? Yuck.
We're taking a risk because when you build a recipe, you want to know everything that's going into it. You don't want to fly blind.
Carlson knew he'd get some iodine from the sugar kelp and some salt to counterbalance the Scottish peat-smoked malt in the beer. But he worried that if the kelp introduced too much of a polysaccharide called carrageenan, that the beer would end up drinking like a milkshake. A few weeks later, the first batch is done, and it's time for a taste test.
I can hear you guys. David, are you there?
I am. Thanks a lot for taking the time to do this.
We're on a conference call with Sam Calagione. He founded Dogfish Head Craft Brewery in Delaware and has a reputation for using off-the-wall ingredients. Carlson cold-called him to see if he'd give his expert opinion on Seabelt. Calagione agreed, and Carlson shipped him some cans.
Pours a beautiful, russet, sort of mahogany. All right, let's do this. That's a nice beer. I get a lot of caramel notes early in the taste.
It's really good. More malty than hoppy. Earthy like the Scotch ale that it's based on, but a bit more salty thanks to the sugar kelp. Marshall Wharf Brewing Company will begin pouring Seabelt Scotch Ale tonight at its pub in Belfast, Maine. For NPR News, I'm Jay Field.
Cheers. It's NPR News.